It's the Mike Tech Show, show number 361. This show is a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. If it's tech, it's here. Please visit techpodcast.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, Mike Smith. Thank you very much for downloading and subscribing to the show. Please visit the main website at miketechshow.com. You can email me suggestions for future show topics or any question. My email address is miketechshow@gmail.com. You can leave me a voicemail message. The phone number is 240-949-2450, and that's Mike Tech Show. All one word on Skype. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/Mike Tech Show. Send me a friend request on Facebook, and that is facebook.com/Mike Tech Show. I have a jam-packed show lined up. Later on, I'm going to get to two voicemails from a listener. He's got two short, one comment and one question that's going to lead into a discussion. And then I have a couple emails, but I want to talk about the consulting that I've been doing, and especially today. So let's work backwards from today. I have this special B&I event that I need to get to. So I'm trying to get ready and head out the door, and my cell phone lights up, my home line lights up. I mean, just ringing off the hook. I'm answering as fast as I can. One of my clients, there's 25 workstations, and half of them, more than half, cannot connect to the server, to the internet, to anything. No network. So clearly, there's something wrong at the back end. So once I start collecting the names, I'm trying to figure out in my head where everything's connecting to. Now, this client, their switches sit in the data center of a former bigger client that I've done a lot of consulting with, but haven't done any in a while. And the bigger client is the client that when I was there, I tried to stress change control. And if anybody remembers when I started talking about that, it was when we hired the new director, the IT director, a new senior network engineer. They're wanting to embrace change control. They were very reluctant. And this is what got that client into trouble in to begin with when I first started consulting with them. The problem is, why do you not want to follow a change control process? Because that's what led to this outage. They plugged something into the switch of my client when I had already said, please do not do anything until we discuss it, until we test, and let's do it after hours. And that's what a change control is about. It's to pause, take a moment, think about what you're doing, and write it up and give it to someone to review the process. There's got to be testing involved. There has to be a backout plan. You cannot plug just any cable, anything you want into a switch without thinking about it. And this is what a change control process presents you with. It gives you time to pause and to think about what you're doing and organize the steps for the change. And then you must inform everybody that could be possibly involved in the change. So if I am in a data center that, let's say, has multiple clients in it, if I'm going to plug cable A into switch B and that switch is a different client, then there has to be a notification process where you got to notify whoever's responsible for that one switch and certainly the business end. And this is how you get in trouble when you don't follow a process. And there should be a process for changing a bat file, literally, if you're on a server and you got to change a file, you need to do and follow a process, a change control process. And I know I read a long email a while back on the really great ideas for implementing a change control process. But you're at a point where if you're not held accountable, then you just go and do what you please because you think you know everything. And I don't care who you are. Even though I'm standing on my soapbox now and I'm talking about this, I don't know everything. And you cannot assume that. And you cannot just do change for the sake of change or have no accountability. You have to be accountable for what is under your jurisdiction. And if whether it be personnel or equipment, whatever it is, if you're going to make a change, and maybe that's the problem. Perception was that this wasn't a change. Oh, we're just adding new functionality. Well, guess what? That's a change. Anytime you're introducing something new, you're fixing something, you're replacing something, you should follow a process and you should document it and you should have it reviewed. Now, I know the only time that you should be allowed to go implement a change without following the whole process is in an emergency. If there's an outage and clients are down or servers down and you got to make changes on the fly, I understand and accept that. But I do believe you should still go back and document it later and kind of have a postmortem on what happened and do an analysis and then document. I've done my best with trying to implement change control with this one particular older client. They don't get it and they never will. That's the final word on it. They've impacted my client today. Now, luckily, it wasn't a long or prolonged outage, but what about down the road? What about if they couldn't get a hold of me and I couldn't solve it because I wasn't available? I don't know. The point to this is do not implement any change without going through a process. Now, what I will try to post up in the show notes is an outline of a simple, basic change control process. That is just a guideline for you to start. And if you are in a bigger company, you're already following this. At least you should be. And if you're not, or it's not part of the organization that you're with, then you should be the first to implement that. And it's going to show what your skill set is and the value. And you're going to become more valuable to the company by implementing something like this because it's going to reduce downtime. It's going to minimize the chance for an outage, and it will show the discipline and the care that you have for what you're doing and what you're responsible for. I know I've spent way too much time already on this, so let me move on to some of the other jobs this week. Well, and by the way, while this was happening, I also received three other phone calls from three other clients, all with different little issues. Some were printing issues that I'm just not going to discuss tonight. And another one was a copier problem where there was a copier tech on site and he needed access to some things that I had to help him for where the access was on the server to that. So I was able to help him. Now, I have an interesting story. I have a new client that's the UPS store. Now, anybody that's walked into a UPS store, you know that they at the counter, they have the scale and they have the workstation. But what you don't know, and I've learned that this week, is most of those systems are all XP and they are very, very old. And they run a program called iShip, which is soon to be upgraded to, I guess, new features and new things. So this program is critical to the counter operations of the UPS store. Now, I just met this client and I receive a panic phone call this week because their system crashed, and I mean crashed and burned hard. a very old Dell workstation, had two 20-gig drives. One of the 20-gig drives just crashed. Now, since there's very small overhead requirements for this software, they really just need XP, IE7, and you need a half a gig of memory, and you can run this. What I did, I took the one drive that was working. I didn't even open the system. They have no data that they care about because it's all up in the cloud, and it's all networked. So all I do is totally reinstall XP. The Dell system was so old, the service tag on the side said Windows 98 SE for second edition. So that's how old this system is. I throw away systems that are faster than this. I install XP, and the first thing I was worried about was, where am I going to get the drivers? I couldn't even find a Dell tag. This Dell system is of such a vintage that the tag numbering system was different. So I was very lucky that the Dell XP installation CD that I had found all the drivers, because the system was just so old that my slipstreamed Dell CD with Service Pack 3 built in found all the drivers. I was able to quickly get the operating system installed and then started the installation process of iShip, and then he was up and running and very, very thankful. And I have a client for life that I was able to help them out and get running. That's, I guess, the reason that I hope you're listening to the show and you download. You got to get creative sometimes on the fly when you're with a client and make quick decisions to keep moving forward. And we didn't have time to go get another system and go, I had the system there. They needed that up and running as fast as possible. People coming in, line forming, and this was a key critical workstation to be able to print those, you know, UPS labels. And then the scale is a serial port. The printer is a thermal type printer that connects to a parallel port and has a special driver that you can address from the iShip software, and it can print. Everything just worked great when I reinstalled it, so I am very, very happy, and it was nice to have a client so appreciative. And then this was my Tuesday, because I take care of this, and then I have four other clients to visit. Because of being sick last week, I had to cancel clients. That it was tough to stick to a schedule, and I'm now just catching up, and I'm still not 100%, and you could probably hear it in my voice a little bit as I'm still struggling through trying to catch up. So it's hard to balance everything where I'm trying to keep everybody happy and all the problems solved as I'm stacking up all visits, including next week. I mean, I'm booked like every waking moment next week. When you are a one-man operation and you're sick, it's really tough to help all of your clients. And I did the best job I could remotely. And luckily, there was no serious emergencies or anything that went delayed. All of the work that I'm stacking up can be put off for a few days or a week. So I'm very fortunate with that regard, except for, you know, these new emergencies that keep popping up. But you got to be able to juggle everything. And then a quick apology to last night to anybody that was trying to tune in for Tech Vets. I had a personal family emergency that was occurring right before I was ready to go live with Carrie. And I had to call Carrie. I had to cancel. And I will make it up to you. I haven't called Carrie back, but we will reschedule that Tech Vets. Everybody has to realize that there are some things that happen that I have to take care of. Real life gets in the way sometimes of podcasting. I apologize, and we will get back on, and we will definitely record that episode. Let's play the first voicemail, which leads into a question for a problem I had with a client, and then I'll tell you what the solution was.
Hi, Mike. This is Brad in California, listening to your last show, 360. The Outlook issue I believe it was in 2007. It may have been in 2003, but 2007, they included a out of office for the intra site, and they included an out of office for external email clients. So if it's only going to external clients, you might want to click on the tab for, I'm on the road, I can't check. If it's going out to external only, click the tab for external clients and turn that one off. It may be that it's not turned off for external clients. Hope that helps. I hope you got the problem solved. I hope you're feeling better listening to the podcast delayed now. And hope you're better. Brad, thanks. Bye.
Thank you, Brad. And that is very good advice. The problem was my client turned on out of office in Outlook. Then when they came back, they put that they were, you know, turned it off after they had turned it on for a couple days. Anybody sending them email, whether they were internal or external, was still getting an out of office message. The solution was the Service Exchange mailbox assistant was not started. When I started that service, everything started working. Just advice out there, if you ever run into that situation, it's a very obscure problem. Now, that server was recently rebooted on the night that I got back from Pittsburgh, where there was a network card problem. What I did not realize was that service did not start properly at that night, because that was the last time that was rebooted. It was a Sunday night. And here we go, you know, we fast forward a few days later, someone's going on vacation. They put on their out of office. They come back, they turn it off, and it's still saying they're out of office. Glad that was solved. But what Brad talked about could have been a problem. Also, if you use Outlook Web Access, you can also turn on your out-of-office that way. So you have a couple ways to turn it on, whether from the Outlook client or out-of-office. And it's things that have to be checked to make sure that everything's turned off if you want it off. Just a great tip, and I've just figured one of those lessons learned, and I wanted to make sure to share it, because these are those tips that, you know, if it ever happens on your watch for one of your clients, or maybe your office or your employer, you might remember what I just said. And, you know, let's check the services. Let's make sure all the services. Matter of fact, after any reboot of a server, you should always go into the services and check and do a sort by automatic and see all the automatic services and make sure that all the services started. But when it's 2 a.m. and you're doing that and you've driven 5 hours from Pittsburgh and you're very, very exhausted, it's hard to remember all of those steps. So that's how you get burned, when you do things when you're tired. Here's a question that Brad has.
Hi, Mike. This is Brad in Southern California. I have an old IBM ThinkPad A30. It was running fine. I started the Windows update, but hadn't actually started doing any updates. It blue screened, and now the OS can't be found. Any ideas? I tried FixDisk, FixMVR. I tried those. None of those have worked. So if you have any ideas how I can get it to recognize the OS, I know it's there. I'd appreciate it. Thanks. Bye.
Brad, great question. And here's the first thing that I recommend. Anytime you have an operating system that's not going to start, do you have data on the drive that needs to be retrieved? Before you start trying to fix it, what you must do is get the data off. And anytime a drive is failing, I look at it, there's only two ways that you can get the data off. You get an external USB drive, you plug it in, and then you make a BART PE bootable CD, and you boot from it and you get the data off if it can read the drive. The other method, take the drive out of the system, plug it into an adapter that takes IDE or SATA and converts it to USB, take it to another computer, and get the data off. Once you have the data off, now you can start your process of trying to fix it. And one of the things you can do is boot from the operating system CD and do a repair. And you can see if you're able to even get to that point. If the hard drive crashed, there are services out there that are not that expensive. There's actually a service, and I'm going to find the name. It's $300, and they get the data off. And if they can't get the data off, I think they refund the money, or you know, they don't charge you. If you go to the site www.300ddr.com, that is the service. They will attempt to retrieve it. So you have options. If you don't have a BART PE CD made, well, I'm going to have a link in the show notes. If you don't have that IDE device or that SATA to USB cable, I'll put a link to that in the show notes where you can buy that from Amazon.com. And these are tools that you should keep handy in case you ever run into a problem like this, where you need to boot a system and get your data off, because that is very, very important. So once the data is off, now we'll look at repairs. Mentioned in the chat, SpinRite. I have mixed feelings about SpinRite. I've seen SpinRite save drives. I've seen SpinRite kill drives. Take that with a grain of salt. Sometimes SpinRite is not the first option that I would go to. I would use that as a last resort, SpinRite. One of the things that you really want to do is run Crystal Disk Info. Crystal Disk Info will tell you whether the drive's bad, whether it's going bad, or whether it's good. You're going to get a blue light, it's good. You're going to get a yellow light, a warning that there's a problem, or you're going to get that dreaded red light, there's a real problem. If you take the drive out, put it on this, on the cable that will turn it to USB, you can now download and run Crystal Disk Info. Let's hope you don't get to the point where you really want to run Crystal Disk Info now before the drive's going to fail. And if you run that and you have a yellow light, get your data off and start, you know, thinking of replacing the hard drive. If you have a red light, you must replace the drive immediately. You have no choice. So you have to do that right away. Brad, I hope I covered, we didn't get over exactly how to solve and repair the disk. But once you get your data off, you certainly have a lot more options. Because if it's an operating system problem and there's no physical problem with the drive, you can always reinstall the operating system, where you can run the repair and try to fix it. You have a lot of options. If it's a physical hard drive problem, well, you got your data off, throw the drive away, go on to Amazon, go buy another drive, pop it in your system, and away you go. Brad, let me know how you made out, and hopefully some of these tips can help you with solving your problem. Let's get to some email, and this is from Mark Williams. Mike, on your last show, you mentioned that adding recent in front of your Gmail address lets you download the last 30 days of email. I discovered this trick about 6 months ago, but for a different reason. I have a small business client who checks his Gmail account on his phone, and whenever email came into his phone, it wouldn't show up on his computer. I found out that if you put recent colon and then your email address at gmail.com or your domain name, if it's Google Apps, I'm just adding that to the email, on the phone and the work email, that the email shows up on both places. Just thought I would pass that along in case other listeners were running into the same issue. This is great if you are getting your email via POP, and now you have an iPhone or an iPad like myself. I have both devices. You can put the word recent in front of your login, and you will get all of the latest email all the time from the last 30 days on all of the devices. This is a very cool tip for anybody that's got multiple devices as you're managing your mail. Mark, thank you. This is from the computer doctor, Kevin, and it's about virus cleaning. Hi, Mike. A few shows ago, you spoke about being tired of troubleshooting and cleaning viral infections. I am also tired of cleaning these rogue infections. However, we have found a cleaning regimen that has not failed us yet. When we know we have an infected computer in the shop, the first thing we do is boot into Ultimate Boot CD for Windows. Here we run an HD Tune hard drive check. I've found this to be more thorough than Crystal Disk, as it does read smart data, but can do a deep sector scan. We sometimes find a hard drive that is having other issues with damaged sectors that we can address before it fails. While in the Ultimate Boot CD for Windows, we delete all temp files, as this is where many infections hide. I agree with that, and I also agree with the program Temporary File Cleaner, TFC, that I'll also add as a link in the show notes, because that is an incredible program to clean all temp files from a system. Then we will typically run a virus rescue CD to do an offline viral cleaning. Next, we'll boot into Windows, usually safe mode, and install Malwarebytes, then run it along with the latest Super Anti-Spyware Portable, Viper's Rescue Scanner, and SpyBot Portable. Yes, it still proves to be a valuable scanning, finding, browser hijackers, and pop objects, and MBAM, and SAS doesn't fail, that SAS doesn't find. So I've kind of avoided and ignored SpyBot because I figured, you know, Malwarebytes and Super Anti-Spyware is a lot better. We've also started running Kaspersky's TDSS Killer Portable, and it looks for rootkits. This is a lot of time. Think about this, you know. While it by no means is perfect, it has found a few things that have eluded Malwarebytes and Super Anti-Spyware. When these heavy hitters have finished their cleaning, we check for browser redirectors by way of a simple Google search for used golf clubs. No, I don't play golf, but when I first started my company, the first client that I had with a nasty redirector years ago, this is what he was searching for. Thus, I'm very familiar with the first page of Google's results for this topic and will know if I get redirected to something else. If a redirector does exist, we break out CombiFix. I've only had one time in the past several years that CombiFix wasn't able to find the problem. We have also noticed that we're having to use CombiFix a lot more the past 2 or 3 months than ever before. So he's running into the same things I'm running into with clients. The final step after the infections are gone is to check IE's proxy settings to make sure it is unchecked and turn off Windows System Restore. I will also add, you know, there's a proxy change that I have found Firefox to be infected with, and have found clients that there's been a proxy redirect within Firefox. So, you know, no browser's safe anymore. We'll also take a look at the registry's startup items and clean it, and a few more other little tune-up things is needed. The good thing about this regimen is it takes care of everything thus far that we've come across on a bootable infected machine. The cleaning process will typically take about a full day to complete, but in reality is only about 30 minutes of technician's time at a keyboard actually working on the system. I disagree. I think it's more than 30 minutes. Yes, it's a full day of cleaning. I think it's more like an hour or two. And Mike, thanks for all you do for us techs and keep up the good work. A quick story. Monday night, I was working remotely on a client and I wanted to do some cleaning, and Carrie Holzman emailed me about something else, and I was asking him about Hitman Pro, which he recommends, because when I ran Hitman Pro, at the end, it prompted me for money in order to clean the infections. And I'm like, whoa, what's going on here? I thought Hitman Pro was free. Well, apparently, it's not quite free, because when Carrie ran it once remotely on my client, it came up and it seemed like it didn't want any money. We ran this again and it said, you have to activate this and pay for it. I'm not a big fan of Hitman Pro, although it identified some things. Is it worth paying for the activation? I'll tell you, I can't recommend it, because right now I haven't, I guess, used it enough, because there's no real trial, you know, to use it. And I want to see something via trial for at least 30 days, you know, run it a few times, see that it's picking up everything, and then say, hey, it's worth, you know, the $29 or whatever it's asking for. But there's still too many free products out there that you can use to clean a system. Now, what the computer doctor said, he's dead on. I'm going to add one more thing that you have to do, and you'll discover this right away. The infestations that I'm finding are turning off the ability for the user to click on executables, because that's how they stop you from trying to fix it. You know, they don't want you running malware bytes. And so what they do is they change the local policy on the system so executables cannot be executed. There is a fix, a registry fix, that you must merge into the registry in order to repair that. So I keep that on my USB stick, and I've often had to run that. I also found another one that totally wiped all of the file associations. How would you like that? Well, I have a batch file that will quickly go through the few hundred file association combinations, and it will run that. You got to have the fixes available. Now, a lot of you out there are thinking, why would you go through all this when you could just reinstall the system? Sometimes it's so hard to put everything back exactly the way the user wants it, that's so difficult to reinstall the software. I have clients that you can't just reinstall software. You got to uninstall it to deactivate it because of license keys, and then you got to reinstall it and reactivate it. You can't just blow away a system. It would be great if that was the answer. Sometimes you have to do a complete cleaning. Then you're okay. That complete cleaning can take some time. So I measured something Monday night. I started cleaning this remote system for a client at 3:00 in the afternoon. It was midnight when I was finally done. But I kind of kept track of how long I would kind of look, you know, go in. Viper rescue just took forever, but it found things. So I'm thinking, what else is left? I ran Super Anti Spyware. It found things that Viper didn't. Malware Bytes found some more things. Just a couple, but it still found some infections. Each program I ran, including CombiFix, all of them found something different. I mean, this thing was seriously infected. But now, my client, running their system, it's beautiful. I didn't have to reinstall all the printers, all the printer drivers. I didn't have to reinstall all of their applications, in which they have a lot of applications. But I will say this, I kind of put that as 2 billable hours, because I would often just go every few hours. I would look in, see where I'm at, come back out, then maybe kick off another program. So I looked at that whole period where I was able to do other things and I could keep it running and I could keep an eye on it in a log me in screen on one of my monitors, but it's a lot of time and it requires a lot of patience. I don't have a lot of patience, but I'm learning to have it when it comes to good and thorough virus fighting or spyware, malware, whatever you want to call it, with these infections. And I'm so tired of talking about it just so many times, but I guess we can't talk about it enough because it's out there. And I want to make sure everybody's armed with all of the tools that's available. And just the email that I'm getting, you're confirming that I'm dead on the utilities and the tools that I'm recommending for cleaning the systems. And then it's the post-fixing that you have to be aware of that never gets discussed that I'm talking about, where it's cleaning up the registry, cleaning up file associations, going in and making sure that you're cleaning the history of and the cookies and all of the possible places of the remnants of them getting reinfected. Which brings me to another problem that I know my client, and he listens to the show, and he said, Mike, could you please mention this for your listeners? Because it's a problem that I haven't been able to solve. He is running Firefox 4.01. And when we try to clear the URL history, it will not clear it. And we pick everything and we restart Firefox and the URL history is still there. When I do it on my system here, same version, it clears. So what could be wrong with his installation of Firefox? And we've reinstalled Firefox. That does not fix it. Is there a bug or something in the clear history of Firefox on 4.01? I'm starting to think maybe there's an add-in or something that is interfering. So I'm looking for ideas of something that I can do that can help him with this problem. And we're not deleting the entire profile of Firefox, and I think we might have to go that far. So what I got to do is make sure that I get all the critical settings backed up so that we can do a proper restore of the settings and then just do a fresh blank install and see what happens. I'm looking for recommendations on that help, and that would be great. One final thing, and I will get to some music, some independent music. If you're buying anything this summer, especially, how about for Father's Day this coming Sunday, how about an Amazon gift card? You could buy anything. Everybody can use something from Amazon. If you can go to miketechshow.com and share that link on the left-hand side of the website, anything you purchase makes a contribution, because you didn't hear any other ads in this show because it's Amazon and Amazon only. So that's how you can help support the show. And I really appreciate everybody who's been using that link and helping contribute to the show. Your price stays the same, but a commission comes back to me to help support the show, and I really appreciate it. With that, I went back and started looking at some of the popular music that I've played in previous shows and haven't heard for a long time. And this is one of those songs that I wanted to play again. It's by an artist, Bonnie Doyle, and it's a song, If I Asked You. Give a listen, and then I'll be back to wrap up.
Lay this down. Would
is Bonnie Doyle, If I Asked You, and I will find her website and link it because I originally downloaded that from GarageBand.com that no longer exists, but a great song. I want to thank all of you so much for your continued support and your downloading and listening to the show, supporting the show, and participating from your voicemails, your emails, your encouragement. Thank you so very much. I really, really appreciate it. And I will be back same time, same channel next week. Bye-bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Mike Tech Show, a proud member of the Tech Podcast Network. Please visit techpodcast.com.